Hi, this is Steve Gallington of the People's News, and you're listening to KPFT Houston.
It is 6 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer of this award-winning show, and every week we place the spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. You know, telling stories is a compelling way to take words and gestures and make sense out of the world. But sometimes sense is best made by validating our purpose in that world. Stories validate our lives by filling in the blank book with which we begin our lives, with episodes to help navigate through life. Stories also validate us by influencing us, simultaneously engaging our senses and trigger thoughts and emotion. Stories tell us about our lives because through them, we learn to feel empathy and connection. Choosing stories we want to tell comes from deeming them important enough to deliver to others and having the courage to be uncertain about what those stories might reveal about us. It's all powerful stuff. And that can best be demonstrated by a powerful storyteller, and my guest is exactly that. After graduate school in Pennsylvania, Sharon DeOrsi came to Houston in 1973 to work in a refinery. Except for her 10-year teaching gig in Maine, Houston has been her home. She describes herself first and foremost as a scientist and engineer, albeit retired from active practice. She is making the Civil War her hobby, not because she was born during the Civil War, but because there are over 40,000 books on the subject, and she knows she'll never run out of reading material. She's also a mother, grandmother, aunt, cook, reader, seamstress, and of course, storyteller. And in my opinion, one of the freshest, most talented tellers in our community. She's been a Moth Story Champion several times over and has been a fixture in our storytelling community. Sharon has been a guest teller on this show before, and it won't take long for you to know why she has been invited back. Sharon, hello, and thank you so much for being here. We've been wanting to get you on for some time. I guess I met you first at a Moth, right? Didn't we ambush you when you came off the stage and said, hey, be on the show?
That is correct. You know, I met you and your colleagues at a Moth event. And I know we'll talk more about the Moth later,
right. But
I have to tell people that it is without a doubt the most fun you can have on a Tuesday night.
It really is.
It really is a lot of fun. Yes.
It really is. Yeah. Except for the night I got COVID. That was in March. And that way, you know, I got COVID at the Moth.
Oh, dear.
Did you know that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that's where you got it. No.
Well, you know what? Damn them. There were too many people there. There always are. And that was the time when it was pretty new. I went there with Greg Audell. And I turned to Greg saying, you know, both of us have kind of this upper respiratory issue. There's this COVID thing going on. You think we ought to go? We decided, oh, the hell of it. You know, let's put caution to the wind. And the rest is history. But yeah, we're going to talk more about that a little bit later. I was laughing about the Civil War. This is an honest to God true story, a 30-second one. Years ago, I remember mentioning the Civil War in one of my classes for some reason, and nobody believed that it actually happened in the world early enough where anybody would ever read about it or know about it. And I brought in an article the following day about three veterans that were alive in 1952, which was the year I was born. And I came in and I showed it to these students and they said, that's impossible. There's no way that happened. I mean, the Civil War occurred like centuries ago. And that's when I asked them when I wanted to know when it was fought. They didn't know. And I just dropped it then. Okay. So the Civil War. Yeah.
Well,
I wish it was everybody's hobby.
Now, on the Civil War, though, I have to tell you a little funny story. And since I made this my hobby, I went to a Civil War seminar this summer in Jefferson, Texas. And we had wonderful lectures and I had the best time. But this, I laughed so hard at this. I was not included in the ladies' photograph of that event because I am not a daughter of the Confederacy.
Wow. Isn't that something?
And, you know, I grew up next to Gettysburg, so that probably, you know, put salt in the wound.
Oh, my God. Well, look, let's get to your great stories. You've got a collection of stories that you have that are really inspired by ways that we can validate our family identity through stories. Tell us what you have for us today and maybe a little bit about your DNA.
Okay. Shall we start with You Don't Look Italian?
Absolutely. If that's going to answer those questions, and it will, let's get to it. You Don't Look Italian. I love that title.
It is a fun title, isn't it? Well, my family has been in this country just a little over 100 years. And my DNA shows that I'm German and Slavic. I am a purebred mongrel of these cultures, which is part of my story, You Don't Look Italian. Although I have been married, I have kept my maiden name, D'Orsi. D'Orsi is an Italian name. Its spelling was D apostrophe capital O-R-S-I, which may have been a bastardization of the name D'Orsini, which is a very common Italian name. My grandfather was John D'Orsi. When he came to Ellis Island, his name was likely Giovanni D'Orsini, but I have no proof of that. I always knew him as old, gray, bald, and smoking a cigar. His wife, my grandma Anna, was German. She was born in New Jersey, but her mother, Joanna, had emigrated from Germany. And while a teenager, my grandmother Anna was wed to another German in an arranged marriage. His name was William Seymour Menninger. And very quickly, Anna and William produced two children, a girl, Anna, and a boy, Ferdinand. Well, William turned out to be a drunk. So about 1928, Anna did the unthinkable. She divorced William and moved back into her mother Johanna's home with her two young children. That scene must have been a zoo. The matriarch Johanna was on her third marriage, having survived two prior husbands. So the family was a large multi-generational mishmash of step families with three different last names. Johanna kept them all afloat, according to my aunt, by making bathtub gin. And my aunt reported that one could literally only bathe when the tub was free of gin production. So I'm guessing there were a lot of sponge baths in that family. Well, Anna went to work in a factory and her income went to the common support. And there's where she met John D'Orsi. Now, Anna was very pretty. She had milky white skin and blonde hair and blue eyes. And soon John and Anna married. However, divorce was forbidden, frowned on in society, and John was Catholic. So William Seymour Menninger was purged from the family history. The children and their school were just bluntly told These children are named Anne and Frank D'Orsay. And John wanted everyone to think he was the biological father. No formal adoption took place, and life went on. So growing up, people would ask me, what kind of name is D'Orsay? And when they told them Italian, they were puzzled. They would say, you don't look Italian. Because like my grandmother and father and my own biological children, there is blonde hair, fair skin, and blue eyes. In fact, we look like poster children for the Aryan nation. Finally, some observers said, your family must have been near Switzerland in northern Italy to have your coloring. But Grandpa said his people were from the Rome area, and so the mystery continued. And the Rome area is where the Orsini name is most common. Well, this story unfolded when I had to do a lineage investigation in order to get my mom survivor benefits from the Veterans Administration from my dad's World War II service. Now, there are a few twists to this story. The funniest one is when my mom and dad went to get married in 1946, Frank D'Orsay could not be verified as her real person because his birth certificate read Ferdinand William Menninger. And then my mom apparently went ballistic shouting, who the hell are you? Well, they straightened that out and they married a year later. So I don't look Italian because I'm not genetically Italian. In fact, Grandpa went a step further in modifying the name before my father, Frank, went into the Navy to make the name look more French because he didn't want to claim an Italian heritage and be associated with Mussolini. Nevertheless, I grew up thinking lasagna was always paired with apple strudel.
So your mother essentially, you know, married a genetic stranger. Okay. So the pure German side married the Slavic side, which leads us to a story appropriately called the Slavic side, right? And that's coming
there
up.
There you right go. Now.
Okay. Let's hear about the Slavic side.
The other side.
Yep.
When I was growing up, I asked my mother, where are your people from? And the answer was always Poland and nearby places like Russia and the Ukraine. But she would go on to say, we never really knew for sure what country we were from because the borders kept changing. And it took me years to understand that, indeed, the Slavic countries were more like city-states, and borders, as we think of them today, were fluid. And there was also, in that part of the world, a constant case of people moving in and trying to take over countries. Now, my mother would tell me that we're definitely Slavic, though, because she would say that all the invading countries wanted the Slavic women because they were the most beautiful. My mother would always tell me that they were the most beautiful. Now, I knew I had a Polish side. The food we ate included pierogi, kielbasy, and galupki. And we had posanki eggs at Easter when we had the Pascha bread blessed at church by the priest. But there was some other influence other than Polish on my grandmother Regina that was a mystery to me. And it was only when I visited the Czech Republic that the pieces fell in place because of all things my grandma's art. Grandma Regina did what's called reverse glass painting. Now, I only ever saw it at her house until I went to the Czech Republic. Excuse me. Now, this is a process whereby the artist paints detail, and when the paint dries, another layer of paint goes on top, adding more details and colors. Mm-hmm. Now, there can be open spaces, so when the painting is completed, the open spaces show the color of the mat that is used for framing. Well, Grandma proudly displayed her large peacock painting. However, the open spaces showed crumpled aluminum foil as the background, but she liked to pretend that it was pounded silver and it looked very elegant. But we all knew it was just tin foil. Now, additionally, Grandma was apparently renowned for her faux bas, or fake wood painting. And I saw this type of work in many places in the Czech Republic. But folks in her little Pennsylvania coal town would hire her to decorate their living spaces. And this wood painting would cover a base of common cheap wood, like pine, and make it look like expensive wood, like walnut or cherry. And this was achieved by adding paint and stain colors and making streaks to make a fake wood grain. Now, Grandma used a special brush called a mottler, and no matter what house they rented, she painted the woodwork. Now, I knew that my grandma was artistic and she was very crafty. She did a lot of fiber arts also. But it's her craftiness that probably led her to her part-time job, which was doing hair, particularly for the corpses in the local funeral home. Now, this discovery of the Czech connection finally explained Grandma Regina's devotion to the infant of Prague. Now, for those of you who are not steeped in Catholic lore, the infant of Prague is a representative of baby Jesus, and statues of him abound in the Catholic Church worldwide. But he is oddly proportioned. He's always standing. He has the body of a man, but the head of a toddler. And in his outstretched left hand, he holds a sphere with a cross on top, telling us that he is king of the world. And in his right hand, he has two fingers raised, kind of like a Boy Scout salute. He's always in this pose. And he always has blonde hair and blue eyes, obviously forgetting that he was born in Bethlehem. He always wears a crown, and most importantly to Regina, a sumptuous gown, because he is, after all, a king. Now, the original infant does live in Prague, in the Church of the Virgin Mary Victorious, in an old part of Prague, pretty void of tourists. And he has dwelled there or hidden there since 1628. He's made of wax on wood and is about 20 inches tall and resides in a protected ornate display case in the church. His beautiful gown collection, which comes from all over the world, is in the adjacent museum. Of course, I had to see the gowns in the museum, and I did buy the catalog. Now, I was most interested in seeing this wardrobe because Regina had sewed her infant an elaborate wardrobe of gowns. And she changed them periodically through the year, but they weren't necessarily tied to the liturgical year. But apparently the infant loves sequins, pearls, rhinestones, and anything that glitters, because that was featured on her gowns. Now, Regina's 2-foot-tall statue of the infant sat on top of her television set. Regina was a terrible housekeeper. So she covered the infant with a heavy plastic shield. This is the kind of plastic that people used to put on their furniture in the old days so that it wouldn't get dirty. So to this heavy plastic, she would add gold and silver ribbon additions. Now, the infant is sitting on the television, but this was before cable or satellite TV. So Regina had what was called rabbit ears antenna on top of her TV. But this gave the infant golden horns because the antenna was behind his head, and his horns would change places for different TV channels. Now, in the house where I was raised, my mother had a small infant of Prague on a prominent shelf. But that was until my brother shot him right off his perch the Christmas he got a BB gun. Now, currently, I honor the infant by having a framed, genuine infant of Prague paper dolls hanging on my wall.
Okay. You know, everybody in my family had plastic on their furniture. It all, and you know, there, nobody had air conditioning, right? So in the summer in particular, I know you're reading my mind, but listeners should know that if you're unaware of this phenomena, you're sitting on this plastic sofa, in effect, there's no air conditioning, your body sticks to it because you're wearing shorts, you're not wearing long sleeve shirts. And when you get up from the sofa, you're in incredible pain. It's like being peeled, right? It's like being an ice cube peeled. Yeah, it was. I never could figure that one out. And I love, the idea of Jesus having blonde hair and blue eyes. I remember my grandmother always saying, you know, I don't understand that. He had to look like a little Jewish boy. And I used to find that funny. But he must have had, you know, dark hair, brown eyes. He must have looked like anyone else who was born in that region, right? I mean,
of course.
I mean, you know, of my course. Gosh. Yeah. I just wonder you how know? It ever happened.
Yeah. So, you know, I have no idea, but I can tell you, you know, I mean, the little infants of Prague that are all over the world have blonde hair and blue eyes, you know, not paying attention to their Middle Eastern German hair, not German, Middle Eastern Jewish heritage.
Right. Yeah. And I love the part where grandmother was making a fake wood. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Fake wood. So she'd be a bird. She'd be like a wood faker, I guess. Something like that. Yes. I know. I don't know. You know, it's late. I'm giddy. Why not? Yeah, that is wild. Well, as you point out, these stories are rich in heritage and reflect different places in history. But you also have some contemporary stories that have defined your adult children. And your next story, Chemistry Rules, will explain.
Chemistry Rules. Chemistry is my first love. I got my first chemistry set when I was 12. Now, that was also when Barbie dolls came out, and I really wanted a Barbie. And my mother said, absolutely no Barbie, absolutely not. It is time for you to grow up. So lucky for me, there was chemistry because Barbie was not happening. Well, in the dictionary, chemistry is defined as the branch of science that deals with the identification of the substances of which matter is composed. And I ask you, when you hear that definition, how can you not love that? How can you not love that idea?
No question about that. Yeah.
Well, I was never a stay-at-home mom. In the old days, Employment was not fluid, and part-time work did not exist for a scientist engineer. So my children were raised by a housekeeper and me, a scientist. And having a scientist for a mom was unusual, if not odd, because I could tell my children about chemistry. For example, when my children were young and we used to ride our bikes to the railroad lines near our house, we would put pennies on the track. And the next day, we would find them squished into flat ovals. And the kids would ask, why didn't the pennies break? And I got to say that in metals, that group of material called metals, the outer electrons are loosely held so the atoms can slide around, and this ability to move makes metals special, allowing metals to bend or flatten. Now, they probably thought too much information, but that didn't stop me. Or they'd say, how does soap work? Huh. Well, let me say, soap molecules are in an amazing group called surfactants, where one end of the molecule connects with water and the other end of the molecule connects with oils or grease. And that's why you use soap and water to wash grease off your hands. But I must admit, did trick my children in a chemical lie, and I was able to maintain this life for many years, for which I am now famous in our family. I told my kids that I could identify chemical compounds by smell. Now, this topic came up because we live in Houston, and there were times that the wind came from the east and odoriferous compounds would make the air stink. Now, I have to do a little chemistry sidebar here. Odor work is actually very difficult. An investigator generally hasn't a clue what to sample for. And even if the investigator has a hunch as to the nature of the contaminant, the investigator probably cannot collect enough molecules to enable an identification. Things are very dilute. Plus, smell is subjective. Now, there are several chemicals that have classic telltale odors. Hydrogen sulfide smells like rotten eggs. And the chemical group mercaptans have a rotting cabbage smell because of the sulfur hydrogen group. And that's why mercaptans are added to natural gas before natural gas is used from heating. You know, someone says, I smell gas. That's because the mercaptans were added and it tells you to get out. Another chemical that's classic is amyl acetate. Smells like bananas. So here I am with my kids, and I am completely bluffing when my kids would say, Mom, what is that smell? But I would, with great drama, roll down the car window and make rabbit-like nose-sniffing motions. And then I'd make something else. I'd say something like, well, I think the base of that molecule is likely an alkene because I think I detect a carbon-carbon double bond. Definitely has a sulfur, probably a sulfanyl group. I think I smell a nitrogen atom in there also. Now, let me tell you, this is all just BS. It is total fantasy. I mean, the idea that someone could smell a double bond between two carbon atoms is just totally absurd. But I never specifically came up with a chemical name. Like, I didn't say, oh, that's aminoethane sulfonic acid, because I'm not that smart. But my children believed for years And they would brag about this talent to my friends, to their friends. And they had some evidence that I knew my stuff because I always had an array of respirators in my car and assorted cartridges to protect against a variety of pollutants. I use this in my work. Well, my sons would never wear masks for Halloween. They would only wear respirators from my car because they thought the respirators made them look like alien insects. Well, my daughter ignored me a lot. She was older. I was so not cool to her. And my older son figured out my bluff in high school. Only my younger son held on to the myth until he embarrassed himself in college chemistry lab. Apparently, he told his lab instructors that his mom could identify any chemical compound with her nose, which of course made him look like an idiot. But it's all part of their legacy of mama's nose.
All right. Yeah. My mom can smell a molecule a mile away. My God. Yeah. Yeah. I can see the next, see the next novel. I love it. Okay. So, chemistry. Yeah. Now I assume you taught chemistry? Cause I know you taught for a long time, right?
Yes. That was one of the taught. Yes. Chemistry.
Okay, you taught, what else did you teach? Chemistry and anything else?
Well, I specialized in an area called industrial hygiene. So, mm-hmm. I also, in addition to chemistry, I taught like air pollution, right. Toxicology, sampling methods. So those were some other courses. And then I also, at different times when I had my teaching gig, I would taught physics and math also.
Right. Well, I knowing you as I do, you had to be just great in class. I mean, people who did not like chemistry had to say, I'm taking Miss Orsi. I mean, I hate the stuff, but I love her. You had to make that class fun. And you know what? One of these days, because we've done this in the past, I want to do a show about teacher stories about, how do you make not really popular classes fun? And I'm just guessing that you have probably got a ton of stories. That is fabulous. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story with my guest storyteller, Sharon D'Orsi, only on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM on the dial, and KPFT any place on the planet. Also, for our friends in Galveston, you are tuning in to 89.5 and 91.9 in Huntsville. Learning how stories define us requires a like-minded group of tellers who surround us with kindness and support. And our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is exactly that group. They meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next story swap will be on November 28th. You can get the link under events on the menu at HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're under events, you can note that the holiday party is held tomorrow, November 16th, at the Women's Institute from 7 to 9 p.m. Not that this should mean much, but I'll be the MC. The cost is pay what you wish. So please, whatever you can find in your sofa and the cushions is going to be fine. WIH is a good friend of our guild and an even better friend of the Houston community. And we thank them so often for all the wonderful support they give us and the fantastic classes they offer the Houston community. This concert will be virtual and in person. Of course, I won't be bringing you any wine if you're at home, but there will be some there. So please, if you can make it, Sharon, I know you've been involved with the Women's Institute, and it's a place I never really thank enough. I'm so grateful for their support. And I don't think people realize some of the great classes they offer the community. Oh. You've taken several there.
Yes, absolutely. I can say that, I've taken a number of writing classes since, I've started this storytelling part of my life.
Yeah.
I have had wonderful classes at the Women's Institute to help me with my writing. And I also have had a wonderful experience with the University of Houston's week-long conference called the Boldface Writing Conference.
Mm-hmm.
I attended that 2 times and I really liked it. And I've also used InPrint, and I've also used WriteSpace. And I'm just very lucky that there have been so many avenues that could help me develop my craft.
Thank you. Yeah, they're wonderful. They are really wonderful people. And again, they're going to be hosting this event. So please, it's tomorrow, not too late. So please come if you can, 7 to 9 p.m. You know, you can also take your skills to the next level, listeners, by joining the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. Also, our friends at the Moth meet up at the Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. You want to get your tickets online. They typically go fast, and you can really have the time of your life. It's a great date night. In about 30 seconds, give us the rundown of the Moth, Sharon.
Well, you know, the Moth is storytelling from participants in the, you know, in the event, and you put your name in the hat.
Right.
And if you want to tell a story, and you see if you're picked. And there are 10 stories told that night, and then there are some judging. But the thing that I love about the Moth, and I have at least 10 friends that usually go with me because they think this is just the best thing since sliced bread, okay? The Moth audience is between 19 and 99 years old, and it is every shape, color, sexual orientation, nationality that you can imagine. It is just Houston all mixed together.
Right.
And the people are so, everyone is very friendly. And I always like meeting the new people who are sitting near with me. And it's just a great time. It is the, if you buy your ticket online, it's $17.50. If you buy it at the door, it's $15. But very often they're sold out. So you're better, you know, to get it online. Right.
Yep.
It's the best. I'll tell you, it's the best night of fun in Houston. Yeah,
it is. It really is. It's a magnificent night. And of course, you know, let's not forget the obvious. If you really want to learn to be a storyteller, watching stories, it doesn't make it they're good or bad. You know, watching people tell stories, reading stories, listening to stories, it's the only way to really cultivate your own style. But Sharon is right. There's from 9 to 99. I'm usually the 99-year-old, but yeah, everybody else is pretty much young. Absolutely. A lot of fun. And by the way, listeners, if you have any ideas or guests that you'd like to recommend for this show, we've been around since 2008, and we are an award-winning show, thanks to you. Please, please go to our So What's Your Story at Facebook.com. Let us know the ideas you've got, or you can email me to SWYS, of course, an acronym for So What's Your Story, at kpft.org. Label it SWYS, and I will get back to you. Okay. So we ended your last story with the legacy of a mama's nose, and you continued to tell your kids stories even while they were in college, which you say gave them a solid sense of who they are. You Are a Peasant is a story that I think will shed additional light on that thought.
Yes, I think that's very important for a child to know, this is who I am. This is my heritage. This is what makes me unique in the world. And one message that my children got in various stories as they grew up is, you are a peasant. You come from peasants. Do not think that you are somehow special because your mom and dad were able to give you a comfortable life. Now, my children, who are now adults and parents themselves, were raised to adulthood in the 70s through the 90s. And I have to admit that those times are different from today. For example, entitlement was not a social concept. And I'm not sure how entitlement became a thing. And it's a concept that I would want to learn more about as a social trend. You know, how do we get to this idea of entitlement? But I don't know the answer. I say consciously, my children, the message was, everyone has to work. Let's find a career acceptable to you that will enable you to support yourself. They never got a message, do what you love. The message was, girl or boy, you must be able to support yourself and your children. And that was the very same message that was drilled into my head by my parents. And let me say, especially by my mother, growing up with coal mines, when the whistle goes off and it's not change of shift, it means that there was an accident and some fathers aren't coming home. Okay. So if you're a woman, you better figure out, you know, what's plan B. Mm-hmm. Now, I would tell the children that they were very, very fortunate. I would tell the children that their father and I had been very fortunate to attend universities. But except for one exception, college had not been part of their family heritage. Grandpa D'Orsi came to the United States from Italy without his family at age 12 to serve as a baker's apprentice. He had to forget Italian and learn English. Now, later on, he learned to be a machinist, and he used his tools to make machine parts. And Grandpa Balan, on my mother's side, the Slavic side, worked as a coal miner in the Pinnacle region. He could barely read. He dropped out of school in fourth grade to go to work. And he had to forget Polish and learn English. So I told my children stories about how my grandma and grandpa lived in the coal region with only coal as fuel for the stove and furnace. And the furnace only heated one room. There was no water heater, and I would help grandma boil water on the coal stove and pour it into a metal tub in the kitchen so grandpa could wash after the mines. There was one toilet in the central hallway of their rent house for the upstairs and downstairs families to share. Then they got more stories from my mother and father, their grandparents. Stories of the Great Depression. Stories of minimal medical and dental care. Stories of combat in World War II. Stories of the sacrifices that were made at home. Stories of rotating only three outfits to wear to work. And then I would tell them stories about how my parents and grandparents always had a garden to grow vegetables. And whenever meal preparation started, it began with a raw potato. And until I started babysitting for 50 cents an hour, I had no discretionary money. Additionally, I told them that until I went to college, all my clothes were hand-me-downs from the neighbors. Now, their own experience with me as their mother was really one of modest living. We always had plenty of food, and their friends were welcome, but the house was small. The boy shared a room. We kept automobiles as long as possible. For many years, our family vacation was camping. We were involved in our community, which before gentrification was inhabited by other peasants. So the question comes up, well, how did all this work? What kind of adult resulted from stories that said, work hard, keep your feet on the ground, but remember you are not royalty. Stories that say, expect to work very hard through your life, but God willing, you'll know love, achievement, and happiness. Well, I'm happy to say, at least in my case, good citizens resulted. People who are humble, thrifty, grateful, unassuming, and generous. People who tip well. People who stop at the scene of an accident and render aid. People who do community service. But years after childhood, my younger son asked me, "Mom, did you trick us when we were kids? Did you want us to believe that we were poor when we really weren't?" And I could have given a very complicated answer to that. But I answered simply. I said, "We were rich in the things that mattered." Recently, I gave each of my sons a large piece of anthracite coal in a vinyl box with a description of the Northumberland coal seam. I got it for their desks. And it serves as a reminder to them that although they have achieved great professional success, they came from peasants.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Reminds me so much of my life too. My grandmother, you know, always said, "Watch Fiddler on the Roof and you'll know where you came from." And I used to think she was joking, you know, but
no, yeah,
honest to God, that is so, so wonderful. I know you felt lucky that your kids turned out to be responsible and kind. You had great parents. But clearly you and their father did a great job in parenting. But there's another set of stories that shape your children with the message that is the title of your next story, which is "Our Family is in the Get It Done Business." That's intriguing. Tell us that story.
Well, in my families, stories created an identity that we get things done in this family. It's kind of a takeoff of the adage, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. So I tried and I try to tell stories of defining a problem and working at that problem until you find a solution. One story is about my mother, Adrienne. Adrienne was a fireball. She was employed as the administrative assistant to the president of a trucking company. And she was in the get it done business here. Remember, this was way before cell phones. Her boss said it was imperative that he discuss an issue with the accounting manager that afternoon. But the accounting manager was out of the office driving to a satellite location. So Adrienne tracked down pertinent information about his vehicle, make, model, color, license plate. She knew where the accounting manager was going, and she called the appropriate location unit of the Pennsylvania State Police and got them to pull the guy over and get him to a telephone. And Lord only knows what story she made up for the police. Another get-it-done tale is of me and my cousin Ellen. We were on a tour of Australia when the bus broke down in the middle of nowhere. The driver got out to look and returned to the bus, informing the passengers that the fan belt was stretched out of shape. So without thinking, I jumped up and volunteered, "No problem. I have a pair of pantyhose in my suitcase." And my cousin Ellen said, "And I have a roll of duct tape." And together we said, "We've got this problem covered." Well, the busload of fellow travelers looked at us like we were crazy. And I said, not diplomatically, "What's wrong with you people? Don't you know you can tie a pair of pantyhose together to make a temporary fan belt? Doesn't everyone know that?" But apparently not. Apparently I was the only one on the bus who knew that. So while the driver called or radioed for a new bus and our fellow travelers walked around looking for kangaroos, Ellen and I got to work. And we did the fix with duct tape, leaving pantyhose as a backup solution. Now, everyone in my family travels with duct tape. You could be forgiven if you forgot your toothpaste, but not the duct tape. And in fact, we have a family saying that says, "If you can't duck it, F it," which of course rhymes when you use the naughty word. Now, eventually, we told the driver we should give it a whirl and get back on the road with our fix. So we did, and we made it to the designated meeting spot where a new bus from Melbourne met us. Driver, tour guide, passengers, and luggage were transferred to the new bus. Now, Ellen and I thought we should get a reward, but we did not get a reward. The dynamics were not what we expected. We learned later that we embarrassed our male travelers by having two old ladies take charge and fix the fan belt. We were surprised that anyone could have that reaction, but then we just gave each other a high five and said, our family's in the get it done business. But the stories continue and they are shared. My daughter, a certified public accountant, swiftly converted a corporation's accounting method to a completely different system after being told it was impossible and would take years. She shared, I guess their families aren't in the get it done business. My son, a registered professional engineer, repaired a piece of equipment offshore in deep water using a mini submarine in an innovative way, not sure it would work. He reported, I was the only one in the office willing to try something new. But then I come from a family in the get it done business. And even now, I see this trait in my 8-year-old granddaughter. When we went to play chess, we found out that we were missing a piece. And now prompting, she jumped up and fashioned a replacement piece out of modeling clay. I think that that's a lovely trait to pass on. Get it done.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. You know, your stories, you're the peasant, you are a peasant, and get it done are asexual. Both males and females are represented. Was that intentional?
No, I didn't start out saying, okay, I'm going to balance this by gender. I did not start out. You have to understand that in my family, women were considered every bit as capable as men.
Mm-hmm.
My father thought that women, in fact, were smarter than men.
Mm-hmm.
And he made that known. And so the stories of my family are of both men and women because we all have these traits. It's not a gender thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, this is a tough question, but I'm curious your take. What is there a difference between who we are and what we are?
Well, this is, you know, the scientist in me would say, let's draw a line. And mm-hmm. on one end of the line, say who, and one at the end of the line, you say what.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you can come up with describers and put them where they belong on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is that traits or actions that are integral define who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think defines more of your activities that can change through the years. So who am I? I am German. I am Slavic. I am a scientist. Now, one mm-hmm. could argue that a scientist could go with what, but when you've done it for 50 years, mm-hmm. it becomes integral mm-hmm. to who mm-hmm. you are. But then I was thinking there are some words that are really hard to categorize. For example, let's take the word mother. Okay. Just because you give birth to a child makes you a biological mother, but it doesn't make you a mother in the social sense of nurturing and raising that child, with love mm-hmm. and guidance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that there's a lot of gray area between mm-hmm. the two.
Yeah.
What am I? Well, I'm a Houstonian, but that was not where I grew up, but I still consider myself a Houstonian.
Right.
So that would be a what.
Yeah. Yeah, but I no, I hear you, and I think that's a great delineation, and I think it's an important one that we think about too. You know, some things we can take, we have control of. You know, for example, my son doesn't have any idea where he comes from, but he has a good definition of who he is, right? You know what I'm saying? And I think so. I think it is important to be able to talk about those sorts of things. It always reminds me of a film that came out recently. It was called The Tomorrow Man with John Lithgow, and he says, you know, some people have to be who they are, even if they don't like who they are. And I thought about that, and I thought that was a really neat quote. It doesn't mean that we don't like who we are, but sometimes, you know, we would rather be someone else, I guess, is a better way of articulating it, right? We kind of wish we might be somebody else, but we're not. We're not. And that's why the stories that you tell, I think, are so very important. Thank you, Sharon Dorsey, for your remarkable wit and wisdom, and you eloquently use it to fuel your stories. You really do. I knew that the first time that I met you, when you were in my class at the Women's Institute. You forgot to mention the brilliant storytelling instructor you had, but it's okay. Don't worry about it. I'll remind everybody. But your stories are laced with warmth and compassion, and I love that. You really are the consummate storyteller, and I am very, very proud to call you my friend. Very proud. Do you have any final words for us about the power of story? If you had like one sentence that you wanted to give us about the power of story, what might that be?
Well, I think in my case, it would be telling stories to your children and your nieces and nephews is just a very powerful way to make them feel that they're special.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. You do. You take them on journeys. You return them safely to the present. You really do take them through windows of your soul. And that's a great, great piece of advice. Don't anybody move because Michael Woodson is up next with Living Art, another KPFT exclusive. Please make Houston's community station KPFT 90.1 a part of every day. Be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? We want you to keep loving a great story. And if you do, we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek. And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't necessarily end happily, it doesn't mean you can't live happily ever after.
Hi, this is the Blues Hound.
And I'm Colleen.
Please join us on Sundays between the hours of 2 and 5 p.m. for Hound the Blues, where you'll hear us spinning the best new blues releases we can get our hands on. Whether it's the newest contemporary artist or simply old school cool, we'll bring the blues to you in all of its many flavors, commercial free and with as little talk as possible.
Thanks for inviting us into your homes each week and giving us the privilege to serve as your link to the blues world and our local blues community.
That's Hound the Blues, Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM KPFT. Houston's Community Station.
Do you find yourself scanning for something different yet familiar? It's at KPFT Houston. Blues and Hi-Fi can be found at the end of our Sunday Blues Block each week. My name is Clint Broussard, and I'd love for you to join me Sundays from 5 to 7 p.m. Central Time for a deep dive into the blues and all of its shades for Gulf Coast Radio that colors outside the lines. It's Blues and Hi-Fi Sundays, 5 to 7 p.m. We also re-air Fridays from 2 to 4 p.m. on our lovely HD2 channel. You can catch us worldwide at kpft.org. It's listener-supported, commercial-free, KPFT Houston. So nice.